For the week of August 11th, 2019, this is Showbiz Sandbox episode 458, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And at the corner of Route 66 and Old Town Road, I'm Michael Giltz.
You know, I know you're not at the corner of Route 66 and Old Town Road. You know how I know that?
No.
Because I can hear the sirens behind you, which means you must be back in New York City.
I am back in New York, but Old Town Road is number one for 19 weeks and counting. Good God. This is the biggest hit of all time in terms of being at number one. It's going to be a number one for a month more than any other song has been number. I mean, it's just crazy.
Let me ask you something. Does that history go all the way back to the Beatles? And I ask
It goes well before the Beatles. The question is the number ones in the pre-Billboard era? There are other charts, and so there are other songs, but I don't believe there's any song that was on number one on any particular big chart that was seen as sort of the national chart for more than 19 weeks. No. So I think it's a pure all-time record as far as we have a recorded history of what's on the charts. But yeah, there are multiple charts that vie for dominance in the pre-Billboard era. And so when you're looking at Louis Armstrong and Bing Crosby and the massive hits they had with, you know, White Christmas and all that stuff, as far as consecutive weeks at number one, I think this is it.
Wow.
Yeah. So, but, you know, I could be
wrong. So nobody has written any hit bigger than this.
Songs have sold more, of course, because this is not an era where people buy songs. Other songs have perhaps been played more. You know, there's lots of ways to determine the biggest hit of all time.
How did this happen?
It's a true phenomenon. And of course, we've pointed out the weird ways it came to prominence and the video coming weeks after it. And now he's fueled it by adding in new guest vocalists every couple weeks. There's lots of fun, interesting stuff about this song. But it's a big hit, and we'll have to see its number one next week.
And let's see if Lil Nas X has another hit. That's what I want to see.
Well, you know, that's hard, yeah. You get sick of the song, and of course, his EP has come out, and this, not much attention has been paid to the other songs yet. A big, big hit can get in your way, especially when it's the first one you have. The Emmys, you know? We're looking for our first big hit. We've got this great podcast, but we were thinking our shot for visibility was to host the Emmy Awards, but no, that's been taken away from us. The Emmys are going to go hostless. So thank you, Academy Awards. No host for the Emmys, maybe no host for the, oh, you know, who knows? We're never going to have a host again.
Well, except for us, we're hosts.
Yeah. So, well, that's true. We're hosting a podcast.
And so I don't like this whole thing where there's no hosts. Just let me put that down, you know.
Well, the fact is that we need a job. So we're looking at a new business. Should we buy the Lamley Art House?
Lamley. And Lamley. As a matter of fact, the reason that that name rolls off the tongue so easily is because guess who founded Universal? It was Lamley.
Mm-hmm. Well, their art house circuit is up for sale. Should we buy it?
Oh, I have to call Greg Lamley and find out why he's selling his circuit. I did not realize that. Because I've been gone for a week. I did not realize that. And IPIC declared bankrupt. I'll tell you, go away for 1 week and everything happens.
Well, IPIC is a luxury chain. They sort of came up with big seats. We'll bring you, you know, you pay a membership fee and then you get free popcorn and soda. You pay a premium price. But when you come sit in your seat, we'll bring you soda. We'll bring you popcorn, unlimited. You'll love it. The problem is that most of what they innovated has been copied by every theater chain in the country. Now you go to Regal, now you go to AMC, and you find big fat seats. You find monthly memberships, lower ticket prices than at IPIC. So everything they offered has sort of been superseded by the big chains. Not quite everything, but their business plan has become the business plan for everyone, in essence. So their uniqueness has been destroyed. And of course, they want you to pay like $5 or $8 more than you would elsewhere. So that's really a hard sell.
Yeah, it's and they're public, I believe. So yeah.
Oh, that makes it harder to negotiate too.
Yeah.
So we need a job. So there was a great profile of James Daunt in the New York Times. He's the new head of Barnes & Noble in North America. He's been running Waterstones, a terrific bookstore chain in the UK. Interesting article pointing out all the things he's done, a lot of which I think are smart and good. Someone said to me, hey, you should talk to him about your website book filter and your ideas. I go, what a great idea. Do you have his number? What a wonder. Yes, I should speak to my sister. Like, oh, you should speak to Apple. I go, yes, I should.
Hold on, Steve Jobs, I'm looking for he's no longer at the company?
Yeah, I'll make a genius bar appointment. Like, what do they think you're going to do? So you know James Daunt, you have a contact system, muckety-muck high up at Barnes & Noble, meaning a person who's there now, not someone who was there. Let me know so I can get an in.
Well, yeah, you can actually write to us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Of course, we are on Twitter, @showbizsandbox is our handle. And of course, we are on Facebook, facebook.com/showbizsandbox is where you can like our page and follow us there.
That's right. And while they're sending me that email and that contact information, what are we going to talk about on this week's podcast?
Well, this week on Showbiz Sandbox, we've got a lot to cover because I'm a terrible person and was on the road and couldn't record a show last week. You know what? God, I've got to really need to read these notes over before starting to record. Next week I'll do
anyway,
it.
Anyway.
Yeah. Well, we've got the latest on the battle between writers and agents, of course, and how is that impacting the WGA elections and Endeavor's upcoming IPO, Endeavor being that big giant talent agency. Of course, it's William Morris Endeavor, but Endeavor kind of has big-footed the name there. Also, Netflix received a ton of attention because that's what happens when you're the elephant in the room. That attention becomes a target on your back. Is Netflix doomed or at least going to be dethroned by Disney? Or is their head start in streaming just too much to overcome? In China, the government has decreed that TV is going to be really, really boring for the next month, okay? We'll explain why. And that Regal answer to MoviePass has finally launched. And full credit to Deadline Hollywood for scooping, Reddit? They got all their information off of Reddit. It's pretty much exactly what they predicted.
It was there. You could have picked it up, too.
Yes, but, you know.
Sarcastic.
Yeah. Well, no. I mean, we called Regal, and we have to be a little bit more official than kind of rumor mongering, but
Ouch!
Yeah, well, who punches throne? In any case, on Inside Baseball, we've got the story I can't wait to talk about. We've got a rundown of music stories with a focus on why there's been an explosion of plagiarism lawsuits. Someone tell Katy Perry to listen in. We've got her back, and I can't believe I'm saying that. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the week's top entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Gilt, and you better listen to this closely, to fill us in on last week's box office. Not last weekend's. No, last week's box office.
Yeah, what do you got against Monday through Thursday? We don't. We love them. And so we've got our look at box office from around the world and for the entire week. We were off 1 week. So if you come to our show notes, you'll find a link to ComScore. That's the soul and heart of where we get our information. We also pull information from Box Office Profit, Box Office Mojo. We've got a link to their stuff in our show notes. Variety, Deadline Hollywood, The Numbers, Hollywood Reporter, New York Times, you name it. And we've also got 2 weeks of our exclusive worldwide box office charts for the entire week. So you'll find the week of April the 4th, where the Chinese animated film No Jia was the number one film in the world. And now you will find the week of April 11th. That's the week we're talking about. Last week at the box office, and the number one movie around the world for the second week in a row is No Jia. That's the Chinese animated film based on a classic mythological tale. It grossed $171 million last week. It's at $500 million worldwide. It is the highest grossing animated film of all time in China. Hollywood movie, Chinese movie, you name it. It's only been a few years where we've had Hollywood movies being able to play big in China. For example, I think the original animated version of The Lion King made about $10 million. Nonetheless, it's passed Zootopia by a wide mile, and it is now the number one animated film of all time for China. We think it cost about $110 million, so that's not well sourced. I found that on Wikipedia, but there's no indication where they think they got that number from. So, you know, if you know better, let us know. We just gave you the information a minute ago. But
can you imagine how many people must be working on this film for it to cost $110 million?
Well, they worked on it for, it's hand-drawn, I think, a lot of it. They worked on it for a number of years, but it is a first-time feature film director. So how we convince people to give him $110 million, I'm not sure. That sounds a little unusual to me. So I think that estimate might be a little high. Maybe it's more like 70 or 80, but I haven't seen the film, so I can't really judge it on artistic level and go, this looks very detailed or something like that. But whatever the case is, I'm sure it didn't cost more than $110 million, which means this movie is easily profitable for just from the Chinese market alone. That's the number one movie around the world. It was also the number one movie last week, which tells you that when Hobbs and Shaw, the Fast and Furious spinoff, if you like, premiered last week, a lot of people said it was number one. This week, they said it was number one as well. It grossed about $86 million over the last 3 days. But if you look at the full week's chart, Hobbs and Shaw comes in at number three, because number two around the world is, I'm sorry, I looked at
it
the wrong week.
It comes in at number two. I was like, I don't know what chart he's looking at.
Yeah, so I scrolled up and down to get my information, and I landed on April 4th, because we have 2 weeks because of eight, you know, your fault. It's you.
This is all my fault.
It's all your fault. Number one is Noja at $171 million. Number two, again, for the second week in a row, never number one at the worldwide box office, is Hobbs and Shaw at $152 million over the week. It's now at $333 million worldwide. It's making decent money. It cost $200 million to make. I saw it and I was shocked.
Why? Boy. Why were you shocked? Were you sitting in a chair that might have been attached to an electrical current?
No, it was so bad.
Okay.
I've never seen a Fast and Furious movie. I don't know why or how that happened, but it did. I have no objection to them. I would have, but somehow I haven't. And I'm finally like, all right, here I go. Hobbs and Shaw. I've got an AMC pass. I'll go see this movie. I'll check it out. I expect some dumb action and maybe a little fun quip, whatever, you know, affable stars on screen blowing stuff up. I had no expectations, and they were not met. I mean, I don't know how they did it, but it was so incompetent and so awful and so badly done, and the action was so boring. I was truly shocked. I assume this is very different from the other Fast and Furious films, but who knows? But really, what a terrible movie.
How have you never seen a Fast and Furious?
I don't know. Paul Walker put me to sleep, and I skipped the first two, and then it just got away from me.
Yeah, by like about 20 years, because let me tell you, I'm sure that if you've seen the one or two of those Fast and Furious movies, you'd be like, yeah, you know, it's kind of the same thing.
Yeah, yeah. Well, those are the big two movies. And I pointed out why Hobbs and Shaw was number two for 2 weeks in a row, because I think our worldwide chart looking at the full week puts into context, you know, how the movie's doing. Hey, these movies are not in competition. Noel Jaws making a lot of money. Number three, The Lion King's making a lot of money. You know, all these, a lot of movies down on this chart, no matter where they rank, are profitable. But Hobbs and Shaw was never number one worldwide, even though it opened up pretty big. It still has China and Korea, two of its biggest markets to open up in. So it's got money. It's going to be profitable, but it is not a huge success the way the last two or three Fast and Furious flicks have proven. So I think that really comes into focus when you look at the entire week. At number three around the world is The Lion King, the animated remake of the animated classic. $139 million it made last week. It's at $1,334 million.
Jon Favreau and Disney take umbrage at your description of their live-action movie.
It is not a live-action film. They make clear it's animated. They're not trying to pretend. But yeah.
Although they do claim it's their most successful live action remake to date.
I saw that spoken of by a Variety or Hollywood Reporter, but yeah. I don't know that Disney has claimed that.
Oh, okay. So basically the punditry, the box office pundits have said that.
Yeah,
okay.
Whoever wrote that, it was in one of the trades, and I actually left a comment and said, really? Isn't that an animated film? Like, I know it's photorealistic, but isn't it supposed to be an animated film? But anyway, at number four around the world is The Bravest. This is a Chinese drama about firefighters fighting an oil well pipeline disaster. It made $85 million last week. It's at $163 million worldwide. And as you can see by that breakdown, it made just as much this week as it did last weekend when it opened up on, I think, Thursday. This movie's doing very well. At number five is another Chinese film. It's Line Walker 2. You know, they're walking that line between legality and illegality. It's a Chinese crime thriller, and it made $61 million on its opening week. At number six is Toy Story 4. That made another $31 million last week. It's at $990 million. Yes, this too will pass the $1 billion mark, as we've been saying for a few weeks now. At number seven, Quentin Tarantino's Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. It's finally opened up in a few other territories. Still, most of its money has come from North America. It made $30 million over the last week. It's at $108 million worldwide. This movie is going to be a solid success story. It's definitely going to get to $300 million worldwide. It's doing great. I keep hearing people who go see it, they like it, casual moviegoers. Though the funny thing is, a lot of them don't seem to realize that this is an alternate history tale.
What?
The Manson murders are not exactly, you know, it's not Robin Hood. It's not imprinted on our brains. And people don't know that they went and killed Sharon. You know, they don't remember these names and stuff. If you're into Hollywood and things, you know it. I've spoken to several people who watched the movie. They have no idea. They're like, so one of them knew that she got killed. It's like, so that was the night before? You know, he thought the movie depicted the night before and that other Manson killer people went the next day and killed Sharon Tate. That's what he assumed happened. Right. Yeah. These people have no idea that what he intends with the finale of the movie because they're not familiar with arcane Hollywood lore. It seems,
you know, it's funny because when I, you know, I saw it in Cannes, as you know, I wondered, there was a lot of content in that movie where it was just kind of a little bit of a sideways glance or a nod to certain, as you
truths.
Say, truths or Hollywood lore. For instance, when the camera cranes up the first time that Leonardo DiCaprio goes to his house and you see the sign, the street sign, Cielo Drive.
Right.
Well, that's a famous, I don't want to say famous, infamous, really, street off of Benedict Canyon that pretty much has been all but forgotten. But that is where Sharon Tate and Roman Polanski lived on Cielo Drive.
Right, right.
But I wondered, I kind of looked around me and went, huh, all of these people, all of these, the crowd the audience I'm watching this movie with from all over the world, there are people from Turkey, there are people from South Africa, there are people from the US. Do any of them realize the significance of showing that street sign?
Well, you know, they don't need to in order to enjoy the film. That's
no, they do
true.
Not.
And I have lots of other people who have seen this movie and liked it, including some serious film buffs who think it's just tremendous. I'm like, really? I'm going to have to go back and see it a second time when I'm ready to have an open mind.
Well, let me ask you this. There was I'm a really kind of person.
But of course, some of these people once said, oh, he did Inglourious Basterds too? He didn't realize that. So casual movie buffs are not necessarily locked in the way you and I are.
Well, let me ask you this, Michael. Did you get the one little nod to Tarantino? It was a very self-referential meta moment in the film.
I'm not sure which one you mean.
Well, and it is, it kind of takes place at something that did happen, which is Sharon Tate and everybody went to El Coyote, a kind of well-known Mexican restaurant, the night of the murders. And she's walking into El Coyote and she said, oh, what's going on down the street at that movie theater?
Oh, that's where the premiere of a porn film was.
Right. And that movie theater is now the New Beverly Cinema, which is owned by Quentin Tarantino.
Right. But it's also a sign of the changing era where, a Deep Throat and stuff was all the rage. And so an adult film, a pornographic movie could get like a premiere, it was a short part of the changing vibe of Hollywood. So I don't know that he was patting himself on the back so much as just sort of, as part of that whole vibe. The fact that was happening that very night is, I think why it's there. But anyway, at number 8, Around the World is Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark, a film adaptation of the short story collections that little kids got scared by, co-written, I think, and produced by Guillermo del Toro, that opened up to an okay $23 million worldwide. At number 9 is The Secret Life of Pets 2. That's chugging along. That's at $375 million, so it's going to pass the $400 million mark. Again, a solid success story. The movie only costs $80 million to make, but nowhere near the success of The Secret Life of Pets 1. And number 10 is Spider-Man Far From Home. That, of course, has passed the $1 billion mark. That's at $1.1 billion. At number 11, an attempt to launch a franchise, Dora and the Lost City of Gold. It opened to $19 million and pretty mixed reviews. It only costs $50 million to make, so we'll have to see how it does overseas, but this certainly is not going to go into the win column in any big way.
You know, my daughters felt that the actress playing Dora was just too old.
Yeah, you mentioned that before, but absolutely. Of course, it's hard. You want to have an actor that's not going to age out of the role in 5 minutes so you can make a couple sequels, but she's supposed to be a preteen, a tween, She's not supposed to be that old, and that just changes the whole dynamic. At number 12 is Shanghai Fortress. This is a Chinese sci-fi flick. It's set in the near future where major cities around the world are under siege from alien forces. It opened to $16 million. I could not find any good reviews, but online on IMDb, one critic whose English is, their English is much better than my Cantonese, so I'm not criticizing them, but they had sort of an attempt to describe the plot and how it wasn't good, and they ended by saying, Chinese shame. I'm like, wow. Ouch, okay. Lord almighty. They really didn't like the film.
So they wrote the review in English?
Yes. Wrote it in a second language so other people could read it. And at the end, they're just like, Chinese shame. This is not a good movie. And number 13 is Exit, a Korean comedy. This is about a dude who's used to be cool in college. He was the best wall climber, you know, rock wall climber. But now he's just got a schmucky job and doesn't know what to do with his life. And he sees a girl in college that he was always crazy about. And then suddenly there's an attack, an alien attack, or a mysterious fog descends on them. And he uses his rock climbing skills to help save her and save the day. It's a comedy with a little bit of action thrown in. It opened up to 16. Well, I shouldn't say opened. It grossed $16 million last week, and it's at $33 million and counting. That's a Korean flick. At number 14, BTS. They finished their tour. They are now resting and relaxing, the boy band, but they have a film in theaters, Bring the Soul, a documentary film about their most recent tour. It made $12 million last week during its special engagement, hit the top 10 in North America. They're the best-selling artists of all time in Korea. They have the best-selling album of all time in Korea, and they're taking a well-deserved vacation.
They're probably not taking that vacation in Hong Kong.
No. Well, they're Korean, but they might have gone in Hong Kong. But yes, no, we're certainly, you know, keeping an eye on Hong Kong. It's a very scary, tense moment. My dad lived there for 10, 15 years. I feel a connection to the city. I've been there myself. It's very scary and exciting what's going on there. I hope nothing awful happens in the end. At number
13. Well, actually, if you go to Showbiz Sandbox 432, episode 432, you'll understand why my good friends BTS, why I mentioned Hong Kong.
Oh, that's why you're making that joke. I thought you meant because the fact that the people are struggling for their freedom and dignity. But no, you're just making a casual reference to some t-shirt a guy wore. I'm thinking about world geopolitics.
No, I'm talking about the time that I met BTS at the Hong Kong airport.
Oh, but they also wore the t-shirt that inflamed passions. Was it Japan? Or yes, I think it was Japan, actually, because Korea and Japan have, you know, a tense relationship.
Yes.
Okay. Well, so they didn't, because they bumped into you?
Yes, they hung out with me for about a minute.
But why would that keep them from going back to Hong Kong?
Well, also because the airport's closed, but that's another story entirely. That has to do with all of the protests you're discussing.
Yes, good Lord. The Battle, Roar to Victory, is a Korean war film. It grossed $12 million last week. It's the story of a 1920 battle between Korean independent forces and Japanese troops, but they clashed in Manchuria. Japan occupied Korea. They were starting to encroach on Manchuria, a territory controlled by China, and Korean independent people took that opportunity to challenge and fight them way back in 1920. So that was going on, and those people ended up fleeing to the Soviet Union, where ultimately Stalin betrayed them. But at the time, they were one of the bright spots in Korea's history, ultimately receiving the highest honors that country could bestow on the people after they were long deceased, of course, most of them. But it's a famous battle. I forget the name of the place where it happened, but it's a famous battle back in 1920, a four-day battle. In this case, it's glorified as including in the Koreans who were fighting the Japanese, a world-class swordsman and a world-class marksman. So very exciting as they face down each other. Clearly, that movie is not going to do well in Japan.
No, but you know, Manchuria, you just mentioned there, I'm pretty sure that's where the latest Democratic candidate for president of the United States comes from.
What is with you today? Good Lord. All right. Anyway.
That's come on. It's a movie reference. I thought you'd like it. Anyway.
Oh, Manchurian candidate. Oh.
Yes, it's a Manchurian.
Well, it would make more sense if you meant it was the president, not a Democrat. But anyway.
Okay.
And number 16 is Aladdin. That made $10 million. That's at $1.035 billion. In essence, there are four films on the charts this week alone that have, or just about to, gross $1 billion. By the time you hear this podcast, Toy Story 4 will be on that list. It just needs another $10 million. So you're looking at The Lion King, Toy Story 4, Spider-Man Far From Home, and Aladdin. Four movies out right now that have grossed $1 billion. That is how big the worldwide box office is getting. And as some people point out, that's how big the gap is between the movies that succeed and the movies that fail. They feel like there's no middle ground. You can't have modest or decent-sized hits anymore. You got to be a home run or you flame out. That's how they feel about The Art of Racing in the Rain. This movie only cost $20 million to make. It opened pretty modestly in North America. It made $9 million. I think it's going to be okay once worldwide box office is all added up. But we'll have to see. Maybe it'll fall off hard next week. Maybe it'll have good legs. It's a doggy tearjerker. You know, a tearjerker about a man and his dog. And the dog narrates the film in the voice of Kevin Costner. It's a beloved best-selling novel. And I say beloved when I mean it's not very good, but people bought a lot of them. And we'll have similarly, The Kitchen. That movie starring Tiffany Haddish and Melissa McCarthy opened to blistering reviews, audience indifference. It cost about $35 million to make. It opened to $5 million in North America. Not doing very well. It's not going to be a success story. But, you know, there are always movies that flop. And while movies can make money any time of the year, August is a time where maybe movies that they're less excited by get released. So it's August and they're releasing these two movies now. There's a reason for that, probably. On the other hand, Yesterday is doing great. That had $125 million. That's the Beatles fantasy flick. And The Farewell is expanding well. That's the Awkwafina drama slash comedy. That's been in the top 10 in North America. It grossed $3 million last week, and it's at $10 million and counting. Since it only costs about $3 million for them to pick up, this movie is a hit, and it's still got a ways to go.
I think it really only three. I thought it was $6 million.
Maybe the budget was $3 million and it was optioned for $6 million. But I would have said if it was optioned for $6 million, then that's what they need to, you know, make at the box office, obviously. So we'll have to check that out. But if that's true, it's still going to get to $18 million worldwide. That's going to be just fine. A couple more.
Go see that movie. It's very good.
A couple more movies on the chart. What is this, Granny? That's a French comedy, sort of an anti-MAME type flick. That grossed about $2 million. In North America, Brian Banks, the true story of a high school football player falsely accused of rape. That also had a very modest opening outside the top 10. And then Lieberkaus Junkie. AKA Meatloaf Junkie. It's a light German comedy set in a small town in Bavaria about a guy who loves meatloaf. It's crazy about it. Can't get enough of it.
Wow. Okay. Probably not going to see that one. Gotta say.
Well, the one also you're not going to see is The Hunt. Universal pulled a flick from its release schedule. First, it said, well, we won't advertise it for a while. And now they said, you know what? We're just not going to put it out.
That's- yeah, I have to say, I remember when I read the description of this movie, I was like, why have I not heard of this movie? And it's because they changed the name of it from Red State versus Blue State to the Hunt. And when I read the description of this, I thought, which executive in their right mind approved this film? Who greenlit this movie? But then I realized, okay, it's a Jason Blum film. You don't want to upset.
Yeah,
it's low budget. You don't want to upset Jason Blum. So you know what? Okay, fine. You want to make this movie? Go make this movie. You've made us enough money that even if it tanks and we lose 100% of our money.
Starred Oscar winner Hilary Swank. There were some big name people in it. So it was not exactly one of his low budget, no name flicks. I don't know what the budget was. I shouldn't say that. But the names involved were more substantial than usual for a Blumhouse product. Nonetheless, I went to the movies. I saw two trailers amongst all the trailers. One of them was for The Hunt, about super rich, wealthy liberal elites who for fun have, you know, Red State Trump supporters kidnapped, dropped in the middle of the field, and they hunt them down and kill them. You know, it's sort of like the most dangerous game, but with a political twist. I'm sure that's all they pitched it as. At the same time, I saw a trailer for Ready or Not, another film about super rich, wealthy people. Their son gets married, and on her wedding night, the daughter finds out, guess what? You've got one night. You better survive because we're all going to hunt you down and kill you. And then that involves some sort of occult thing. But nonetheless, it's rich people gunning down poor people, or at least middle class people. And I thought, wow. You want to talk about a glimpse into the psyche of the country right now, the gap between the haves and the haves not. Here it is right on the big screen for you.
Well, you better hope that it doesn't turn into, I don't know, Les Miserables, where the masses rise up, because that didn't end too well for the king and queen.
That's right. We referenced briefly how the masses were rising up in Hong Kong, and there's a lot going on in China. For example, China blocked the Korean Palme d'Or winner Parasite from screening as the closing night movie at the Chinese Film Festival. Yet again, you feel like, okay, China, you want to censor things and block things and control things. Do a better job of it. It's your own film festival in your own country. And Parasite was a known quantity long before they announced it as the closing night film. So this just feels like incompetence. So those censors need to get on the ball so they can do their job more invisibly and not let
the... What was the reasoning given? Parasite has nothing to do... Like, I don't see what the...
Who the heck knows? But we do know it's the 70th anniversary of the People's Republic. That looms large right now. And so the government sent out a directive stating that now, in August, and for the next 100 days, for the next 3 months, there should be no TV shows airing that are overly entertaining. That's a quote. We don't want overly entertaining stuff. You have to stick to propaganda. You have to stick to, you know, country and government enhancing films and documentaries and TV shows. Here's a list of what you can show. Everybody needs to show these 86 shows. Everybody should air them all the time for the next 3 months.
And so basically, it's like the
the
50th anniversary of the Apollo 11 moon landing, except it has to last for 100 days.
And you're not allowed to show anything else 24 hours a day, 7 days a week on any channel of all the 500 channels you have. Not that China has 500 channels. But
there may be a revolution in China yet.
Just for that. Yes, exactly. Yeah. So, I mean, what a nightmare. All these networks and streamers were scrambling to release more episodes of shows that were already, you know, if they had three episodes to go, they didn't want to make you wait 3 months to see the last episode. So they've been sort of jumping around to go, holy moly, they didn't know anything about this, obviously. So they've been jumping to do that. What a nightmare for all the channels. And imagine you live there and have to watch the same boring propaganda over and over again. And, you know, we talked briefly about those on-demand parlors, those private parlors where people can go and say, hey, I want to watch this or that. If that's the case, those suckers are going to be jammed for the next 3 months.
Yeah, that's probably true. Yeah, those like private cinemas.
Yeah, now what's happening with the Golden Horse Awards? Because those are like the Academy Awards.
Our tickets arrived, Michael. Our tickets arrived. And it's unbelievable. We're in the front row.
Oh, we are. That's awesome.
Yeah, woo-hoo! It's pretty rad. I couldn't believe it. First of all, we were invited.
Yeah.
And secondly, front row seats.
I've got friends in Singapore. Maybe they'll join us in Taiwan. Yeah. We'll all watch it together.
Yeah, you know what? Unfortunately, nobody else will be there.
What?
Apparently last year, China totally freaked out that all these political statements were made at the Golden Horse Awards. And of course, all the Chinese talent that was there was like, hey, man, we had no idea.
No, they fled. Okay, fled the after party. Some people didn't go back on stage. They went home right away. They're very cautious. They're careful. They live in a totalitarian state where the government controls everything. And they knew that this was big trouble. And now the fallout has really hit.
Yeah, because now this year, basically China has said, yeah, Chinese-owned studios are going to boycott the most important awards that are held in China.
In Asia,
in Asia.
Yeah.
And then most of the Hong Kong companies went, well, you know, we're going to do the same thing.
Yeah.
You know, just
imagine you are having the Academy Awards and every major studio says, we're not going. And now I wonder if they're allowed, if they can choose, and there's no reason why they couldn't, it's their own award show. They could choose just to honor the best shows, the best movies of the year. They don't have to have the people in attendance. I don't know what the rules are, but they can just say, hey, we don't care if you don't submit it. We're just going to decide to nominate the same movies we would, just so they don't make their award show a farce. Because if they can't honor any Chinese or Hong Kong flicks, it's going to make the Golden Horse Awards this year ridiculous.
So, yeah, I agree. I think, you know, it's just like when the Golden Globes didn't actually hold a ceremony. They just kind of held a press conference and announced all the winners.
Oh, the year where there was
a writer's strike.
Mm-hmm. They feel like they're going to have a show. Yeah. But but nonetheless, you want to make sure the awards don't become foolish. And so maybe they'll just go ahead and do that and not have a ceremony. Who knows what will happen? But it's just another sign of the control China has over its country. And it's a popular culture. They want the box office. They want the money flowing in. They want the soft power of movies and TV shows being watched all over the world. But they don't want to allow the creativity and freedom to make that happen and be successful long term. So that's going to be a real tension in years to come. There's still tension at the WGA, isn't there?
Yes. So, of course, we have been talking for some time now about how all of the writers, the screenwriters, whether television or film, have fired their agents, okay? And that's because long story short, there is packaging fees in television that the writers don't like because they don't get any piece of them, and the agencies are making more money than the writers. And there are affiliated production companies that agencies now own and run, and they're basically selling to themselves.
Yeah, like, we'll negotiate for you with us to get you the best possible terms. Sure, you will.
Unfortunately, boy, that affiliated production company was really harsh on us. You're going to be working for us for free. Go figure. I mean, by us, I mean the affiliated production company, not us.
Exactly.
But so the WGA is holding elections, and now, you know, what is normally kind of an uncontested thing that maybe has, you know, one or two people running. And
I don't know about that. It's for the board. I don't know that it's uncontested. They always seem to be.
There's always an election. Uncontested
is people have different philosophies of what should go forward. You see, the actors always have, you know, different groups that feel, no, we should be doing this and focusing on that. So I wouldn't imply this is the first time there's been serious you know, philosophical conflict at the WGA or their elections.
Oh, no, 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 not at all. I mean, especially during strike years.
Well, that's what you just said. You just said, oh, well, you know, they okay, have their little elections. Yeah, no, it's a serious election. But this year, there's a string of candidates who went up and said, I want to be on the board. But they've dropped out because they want to make sure that their side is getting support. Most of these people who have dropped out have been saying, we support the current board and their hard-nosed negotiating stance. As opposed to the people, and there's hundreds of them, if not thousands, who support the upstarts who say, hey, you guys are playing too hardball. We don't know what your end game is. How is this going to end up and work out? Is it really realistic? You know, those are the two sides fighting it out, and it's getting really serious. But there are success stories to point to. We've had a string of mid-level companies that are part of the talent agency world who have signed on, 100 of them so far, but two or three of them that are actually affiliated with the, what's the name of the group?
The Association of Talent Agencies,
the ATA. That's right. And most significantly, to my mind, Endeavor has delayed its public offering, its initial public offering. They wanted to go public and raise a lot of money that way. They announced it, and then they paused it, and now they've paused it again. And clearly, that's because of the uncertainty surrounding their battle with the WGA. And that has to be seen as a success story for the writers.
Yes, because now they're messing around with people's money. They always were, but now they're messing around with the agent's money. And so,
right, you've been profiting off of us. Guess what? When we play hardball, you find out suddenly we actually matter.
Yes, correct.
Right. It's not that they want to screw Endeavor over, but they don't believe Endeavor should be a public company. They don't want agents who are in a public company to represent them because they believe the short-term quarterly needs of a public company are different from nurturing talent to have a long, healthy, and positive career.
But, you know, Netflix is public and, well, they found out last week and, you know, over the last 2 weeks, what that could actually mean for them.
Well, one big announcement was that Disney said that they were going to have a bundle for Disney Plus, and we knew they would. Disney Plus is going to cost like $7 a month. That's their streaming service that has all sorts of content coming out, but they're not going to have a bundle. Disney Plus plus ESPN plus Hulu. All for just $13 a month. So you get all three channels, Disney Plus, ESPN, and Hulu for just $13 a month. So that's
now,
some serious competition.
Don't you get like, the local channel? I don't want to say local. That's the wrong word. But don't you get NBC, ABC, and maybe not CBS,
well, those
but
are
NBC
free.
And
ABC?
But on Hulu, don't you get all of those
That programming? You get reruns, but not necessarily in the future because Hulu is now owned by Disney and there are people who may be pulling their stuff and eventually take it elsewhere. But yeah, they're known for having reruns of network shows.
Okay, so and
you're
by
thinking
reruns,
this is
I
like
mean,
a skinny the skinniest of skinny bundles?
Right.
Well,
I mean,
yeah, it's not everything though, and it's you know, you don't get everything and you have to wait. And it's not every show on every network, and there's lots of content that isn't on there, like The Voice. And other big stuff that you like, or you know, reality shows. So yeah, it's not a.
You would think my cable bill should be declining, not going the other way.
Well, that's certainly what I think. I think that all this pressure of the streamers and all these companies announcing the streaming services, I think the pressure is going to be on cable companies. Instead, the pressure, at least in the media spotlight for the last week, has been Netflix. Netflix has been under the spotlight. It's not been good. They had a quarter, we talked about it 2 weeks ago, where they lost subscribers for the first time in 8 years. They had a quarter where they did not gain subscribers. And in fact, their worldwide totals, they gained subscribers, but about half the number they anticipated. They thought they would sign up about 5 million people. Instead, they signed up 2 million plus. In North America, they actually lost a couple hundred thousand subscribers.
Yes. Which is why I immediately went and sold all my stock,
That's
which I didn't
right.
know in the first place.
Right. And they said, you know, we raised our prices. And all the territories where we really did raise our prices, those are where we lost people. So it's sort of expected. We didn't lose a ton of people, but we lost some. You raise your prices, there are some people who are going to pull out. And we expected that. And it's a slow quarter. We didn't have a lot of new shows. Next quarter, we're going to gain subscribers. But the whole world acted like Netflix is gone. It's dead. And in fact, they lost like $17 billion in value in just 24 hours. Now, is that a sign of how much Netflix is struggling? Or is that a sign of how big it is already?
I think it's a sign that of how big it is already and how many people wrote about how Netflix is going to be struggling in the future and this is the end of Netflix. And I think, you know, whether it's the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, Forbes, all writing these kind of opinion pieces and these prognostications about how, you know, it's going to suffer in the future.
They've got Disney Plus and Apple TV and Universal and HBO Max. They're all coming online and going to crush Netflix.
Right. And so everybody went, oh, better sell our stock. And so they did that all at once. Never a good thing. I do think that if Netflix, and this is kind of a little joke yet true, if they said, okay, that's it, no more sharing usernames and passwords, I wonder how many subscribers they'd get out of that. Like whether people who are now, who are hooked on it and would say, fine, I finally have to buy my own subscription to Netflix.
Well, they are a company that's valued, at least as of like early this morning, at $135 billion.
Oh my
God. So when they lost that $17 billion value, well, that was like 5% of their total company value. That's a lot to lose in 24 hours. And to put it in context, $17 billion of lost value, that's more than Viacom is valued entirely. Viacom is valued at $12 billion. CBS is valued at $19 billion. They almost lost the entire value of CBS in one day. Now, are they...
So you can see, by the way, why... You know, not only for the purposes of operations and development and investment, but you can see why Viacom and CBS want to remerge
because there's the big 200-pound gorillas surrounding them.
Yes, and they're very vulnerable.
Yes, exactly. Well, vulnerable may not be the right word, but they think bigger is better. I don't necessarily agree.
No, meaning that you got people running around spending $70 million on Fox. So somebody can come along and easily scoop up for, $15 billion, which it would be a premium. They could easily scoop up Viacom.
Right. So you joke that, hey, it's August. People got to write about something. But losing $17 right. billion dollars in value in 24 hours, that'll give you something to talk about. And of course, next quarter, they will add subscribers and people can write their story saying Netflix is back. There's two questions here. One is, will Netflix stock go down in the next day or week or month? I don't know.
Now that we're talking about it, yes.
I don't know. Well, we should be talking it up, but I don't know and I don't care. I'm not playing the stock market. I don't gamble like that. Our question is this a company that's in good shape long term? And we feel like, I think it is, or do we need a reality check?
No, I think, it's here to stay for the foreseeable future. I don't think it's going the way of MySpace, that's for sure.
Well, what are the cons? What's working against Netflix? Obviously, all the competitors.
Well, and you can cancel in a heartbeat. You know, it's month to month. There's none of this like, oh, you have to have it for a year or, oh, well, if you cancel, you don't get the local channels and you don't get sports and you don't get news. You can cancel anytime you want.
Right. And unlike if you cancel your cable subscription, you've got a lot of things you need to make up. It's just like canceling HBO. One phone call right. and it's gone. But if you cancel your cable provider, you got to get a skinny bundle. You got to get Wi-Fi. You got to figure out, what you want to do, if assuming you want to watch any TV ever again. Which one of these streamers do I buy? So that's more complicated. But Netflix is a pretty easy. You go online, click, click, and you're done. So that's true. Do you think people will cancel? Do you think there are people who literally will say, gee, I like to watch Friends on reruns every single day of my life. If they don't have Friends, I'm canceling Netflix.
I think a lot of people are watching Friends that had never seen Friends before. And once they binge watch it and watch all of the episodes, they don't need to see it again.
Right, kids. So, yeah, even if they like to watch it regularly. But on the other hand, if the cupboard seems a little bare, if they keep looking at shows and flicking through the list of stuff and go, wow, I've seen everything I want to see. You know, if they don't see stuff, they go, I want to watch that. I want to watch that. I want to watch that. That's a problem.
But you know what? I kind of liken them to HBO, and I'll never forget the... when
Sopranos?
Netflix, when Netflix first started making its own original content,
House of Cards in 2009.
And all of a sudden, all of the executives I knew at HBO, over drinks or, over dinner, they would kind of complain. They'd say, look, Netflix says it's not my competitor, but you know what? Stop taking the content I wanted to buy. If you say you're not my competitor, I wanted to make that series. You then went out and offered the people more money, and all of a sudden they're making it for you rather than me. So we are competitors. And finally, Netflix kind of said, yeah, okay, we're competitors. And so that said, I kind of go back and say, just like HBO, Netflix has to make itself relevant. HBO had to make itself relevant rather than just kind of take old movies or movies that were,
And they made original content.
They made original content. And then when that content grew old, like The Sopranos, and went off the air, like Sex and the City, they found other content.
Just like CBS has to do. I mean, you don't turn into CBS unless there's a show to watch.
Right. And so, people would actually say, well, Sex and the City's off the air and, Curb Your Enthusiasm's off the air.
Game of Thrones is off the air.
Yeah, I'm going to cancel my HBO. Well, guess what? HBO just like Netflix, has to go out there and say, well, here's the next great show that everybody's going to be talking about. And if you want to be talking about it too, you have to have a subscription. Same concept.
Yes, yes, it is. And is that a plus or a minus?
Well, I think it's a plus. They at least know the path they're walking down.
Right. Well, they've had to pivot over the years. That's true. The first, I used to mail you DVDs of other people's movies and TV shows. Then they said, well, people are going to want to stream that content. So they pivoted to offering both physical DVDs and you could stream the movies and TV shows. You didn't have to get a DVD in the mail. You could just stream it to your phone or laptop or TV. And then they said, you know what? We're spending a lot of money on content. We're renting Friends and movies, Adam Sandler flicks and all this stuff. And we know they're just going to keep charging us more and more. The more successful we are, the more money the studios are going to want for their libraries that we rent for a year or 3 years. And so they pivoted to creating original content. They've spent the last 6 years preparing for the loss of shows like Friends and The Office. It's not like this is catching them unawares. So, you know, they started with House of Cards and Orange is the New Black, and they've invested billions in original content. They've spent $18 billion on both libraries, acquisitions, and original content last year. They're the home of stand-up comedy. They've signed a ton of big-name talent like Shonda Rhimes, Ryan Murphy, the Obamas, and now they've won the bidding war for the guys behind Game of Thrones. So, you know, they're going to always have to come up with a new thing. They're going to have to remain relevant, but the bigger their catalog gets of original content, the more people go, hey, I've never really watched Orange is the New Black, or I want to catch up on Stranger Things or Glow. You know, they're going to be okay. They don't have to be number one. Disney Plus could pass them, but they've still got 160 million subscribers worldwide. And I don't see them being complacent, and I don't see them being particularly dumb. It's not like I think they're the best company in the world and they can never stumble or go wrong. They got a lot of challenges. But, you know, if you could point to me something they weren't doing or something they were doing, you know, well, we've pointed out, right? They're spending on movies is a little too, you know, $200 million for a Martin Scorsese flick. That's a big expensive mistake. I don't care if it's the best film of the year. You know, unless it grosses $600 million, which is not going to happen. That's just a mistake. You know, it doesn't.
Or unless you get 10 million people to subscribe for 3 months just because of that movie.
Right. And that's not a realistic expectation. And even if it turns out to be Titanic, meaning a huge success story, that's not something you should be doing every week. That's just not a smart use of their money. So we do see them doing some, you know, making some big movies that seem bigger budgeted that makes sense. Sure. But in general, they seem to be doing pretty smart stuff.
Yeah, you know, I watched that and I said, watched the trailer for that and I said, it kind of feels like Goodfellas departed and went to Casino. Get it? Goodfellas departing Casino.
Yeah. Very good. We'll have to see how that movie does, but that won't be a big deal or a big whoop because it's just one film and it's a lot of money, but that's not going to take Netflix down. But it will indicate whether they do more of that stuff in the future.
Aha. Well, you did mention big deal or big whoop. Which, by the way, is our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. So why don't we get into it and we'll run through some of these. Since we're running long, we're going to try and do it quickly. Our first story, it was a big few weeks for casting directors. First of all, they decided that we were, very, you know, popular and should be cast in everything.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah, keep going.
The office. Yeah. Well, okay. Also, first, at the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, longtime board member David Rubin became the first openly gay man and, oh, by the way, the first casting director to head that august institution. Well, with a gay man in charge, maybe now they can produce a good Academy Awards. And across the pond, the BAFTAs announced they were adding a category for best casting. Is this all a big deal or a big whoop?
I think it's a big deal. BAFTA adding the best casting category, especially if it doesn't just become a lockstep, oh, whatever the best picture is will win best casting. It should be the movie that discovers a lot of great new talent or is really smart or discovered somebody and made them a star, even if that movie didn't become a huge, you know, best picture nominee. You know, I hope they're smart about it and it's not just, whatever the best film is gets makeup and, you know, editing. I hope it's a really good category that shines a spotlight on what casting directors do.
Who's going to write the press release announcing our next story? Well, it might be the PR firm Rogers and Cowan. They're gigantic. Mm-hmm. Or it might be the PR firm PMKBNC. And believe it or not, that's two PR firms that merged a long time ago. Well, not a long time ago, but...
Some time ago.
some time ago. Actually, by the way, it won't be either of them because those two behemoth PR firms have merged into one giant press releasing monster to be named later. This PR firm on steroids will boast a roster of 500 clients from the worlds of film, TV, music, fashion, sports, corporate, more, including, I assume, podcasting, by the way. Yeah. But they haven't called us, so who knows. Among their clients are Microsoft, YouTube, Verizon, actors like Michael B. Jordan and Brie Larson, to Robert Redford and Glenn Close, the directors Joe and Anthony Russo, athletes like Kobe Bryant, musical acts like Elton John, Katy Perry, asterisk, we'll be talking about her later, the Rolling Stones, and the Dixie Chicks, who, by the way, are in the studio recording a new album, they want you to know. So is this mega merger a big deal or a big whoop? And of course, if you ask them, it's a big deal. Just look at their press releases.
I think it's a big deal, but not in a good way. You know, I don't think bigger is already better. And it's like, oh, you know, I don't want to feel like I'm lost among 500 people.
Yes, and by 500 people, it's 500 publicists all, you know, clamoring for attention. And yeah, I agree with you. When PMK and BNC, two separate firms, when they merged, it was a big deal. So the fact that those two giant firms merging to make one giant firm was a big deal. Now you've got that big whale merging with another big whale. It's pretty remarkable.
Yeah.
I would say, you know, there might be some antitrust issues here, or, you know, there'd be some Department of Justice, but
nobody will care.
Nobody will care. Nobody will care. Not at all. I agree with you. Now, the world of TV, syndicated news magazines like Entertainment Tonight, it's usually as staid as the morning programs like Today and Good Morning America here in the U.S., where hosts remain in place for years and change happens very slowly, and then, like the Today Show, all at once and overnight. Not right now, though. The Warner Brothers show Extra fired AJ Calloway after 14 years when multiple allegations of sexual assault rose and an internal investigation about his behavior at work raised even more issues. Meanwhile, Access Hollywood has a new executive producer. They parted ways with co-anchor Natalie Morales after just 3 years and brought on Mario Lopez, who used to be at Extra. And now Entertainment Tonight, the granddaddy of them all here in the U.S., is facing changes. Nancy O'Dell has been co-anchoring it for almost 9 years, but she's walking away to spend time with her 12-year-old daughter. At least that's what she says. And of course, will have some new high-profile job in the blink of an eye. Before Entertainment Tonight, Nancy O'Dell was the co-host of Access Hollywood for 13 years. Whew! Oh, just a lot of stuff to talk about. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. It's a lot of change in a world where not a lot of change happens. So it's musical chairs. Everybody's got a new seat. I love Nancy O'Dell. I thought she was great on Nashville Star, a competition, a talent competition show that I really liked. She's a real talent. It'll be fun and interesting to see where she goes next. But that is a lot of change in the news magazine world.
And I liked Billy Bush's advice to all of them, which was, remember, your mic is always on.
Yes.
Yes. You know, CinemaCon used to actually, the awards there, which are kind of a gala event at the end of each year. CinemaCon, it used to be hosted by Billy Bush because it was hosted by Natalie Morales because she took over Access Hollywood. I wonder if Mario Lopez will take it.
He might. By the way, speaking of morning news programs, I just saw the first teaser trailer for The Morning Show, the Apple TV drama, you know, with Reese Witherspoon and Jennifer Aniston and Steve Carell. Oi, oi, boy. I thought that in my mind, the show was, you know, backstage machinations and all that. But this was just like, they think they're doing Aaron Sorkin and the West Wing. You know, it was so self-important and so the morning news program is just destined to tell the world. You know, it's like, oh, it just looked awful. it just was so, but anyway.
The annual survey of the most popular plays and musicals being performed in high schools around the U.S. is in.
Yay!
And I feel like we've done this story 12 times this year. It just means we've done this story 12 times, which is making me feel old.
That's because we've been doing this podcast for a decade. You started in April of 2009. I started in May of 2009. And we focus on the numbers, like when we get to 475 or episode 500. But hey, you should have raised a glass to the 10th anniversary of Showbiz Sandbox, which just happened a few weeks ago.
I would have, but then I would have been drunk while doing the show. It would have just been, we're already so long. Could you imagine how long that show would have been?
Yes.
As you might expect, by the way, very little has changed in the plays and musicals being performed at high schools. The Addams Family is the most popular musical for teens. And the series of shorts about love, known as Almost Maine, tops the playlist. After that, familiar friends abound. Mamma Mia is the second most popular musical because, you know, nothing says kid-friendly fun like a musical about a woman that slept with so many men in a short span of time that she isn't sure which one of them is their father, the father of her daughter, at least. Then came four Disney musicals, Little Shop of Horrors, Shrek, and so on, with number 10 going to The Wizard of Oz. On the big playlist, Peter and the Starcatcher is the most successful recent entry at number 3, with an adaptation of Clue at number 6. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop, of course, but it's always interesting to see what kids are performing. Every year when you have the annual talent contest, people come in and they do songs from the Addams Family, you know, kids from all over the country who've succeeded at the regional levels, and they come to New York and they compete for the Jimmy Awards. I'm like, why do people do the Addams Family? Good Lord, how is that a musical that anybody wants to put on? Who knows? But, you know, speaking of musicals, there's a musical about Diana, the Princess of Wales. They've just announced that is coming to Broadway in the spring. Oy. And matinees, Wednesday matinees. This is an interesting business thing I'm going to keep an eye on. They might be a thing of the past. Disney Theatrical has gotten rid of them completely, I think. The Lion King and Frozen perform on Sunday night instead of Wednesday matinee. And now Aladdin performs on Monday night instead of Wednesday matinees. So they all do 8 shows a week, but they're finding it smarter for them to put a show on Monday night or Sunday night, get people there in a jam-packed weekend or fill in that night of Monday rather than doing it during the day on Wednesday, which is always the lowest grossing performance of the week.
What is going on behind you there? Is there like
they're coming for me. It's New York. There's 8 million people. There's always something
okay,
going
well,
on.
Obviously, they're all under arrest.
Yeah.
Now, ebooks may be for phonies, but soon J.D. Salinger's work will be available in that format anyway. In music, some key artists held out from streaming for a long time. Why let people access your music for free when you can get them to buy the entire album? That was the feeling of some big guns like, say, Led Zeppelin, Garth Brooks, and, remember, the Beatles. Finally, they caved because, as the Beatles realized, if you weren't on streaming platforms, young people simply weren't going to listen to you. And they've, in fact, you remember when they were like, who's this Paul McCartney guy?
Yeah.
When he was like, A similar pattern held in books, though not as firmly, since people still had to buy ebooks rather than getting access for pennies on the dollar. Nonetheless, some big names from the 20th century held out, and now one of the last of them has caved. The estate of J.D. Salinger has agreed to let his publisher, Little Brown, release the 4 volumes that made Salinger's name, including The Catcher in the Rye. It's the first step in a wave of publishing, including, yes, volume after volume of the many works Salinger wrote in the decades after he stopped publishing. But movie adaptations, plays, or audiobooks of his work? Yeah, no thanks. Those really are for phonies. If you want to experience J.D. Salinger, read them. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop, I guess, in a context. But you know, thank God they came to their senses and realized we have to be an ebook. You know, you cannot be not be in that format. I don't care what people say. Oh, ebooks have faded. You need to be on there. You need to be available. And they realized the son. I think his name is Michael. He's an actor or was an actor at one point. He's realized in Asia people do all their reading on their phones. Young people especially. He had old people calling him and saying, I want to read them, but I need larger print than I can get. You know, and ebooks let me do that. And he has a woman in her 80s saying, please print the rest of your father's books so I can read them before I die. So he's under a lot of pressure. I hope he's making the right decisions. In this case, he certainly is.
Yeah, I wonder about all of those books, whether they're academic or meaning, you know, are they going to be considered books? Or are they going to be considered, you know, works that were never really finished and, you know, weren't actually published? And so they're more, like I said, academic.
What? Is what academic?
You know, they're more, all the books that he never published.
No, it's fiction. No. It's not, I don't know what you mean by academic. No, it's more stories about the Glass family, short stories, novels, novellas. No, it's nothing to do with. It's not.
But were they finished? In other words,
Yes. Absolutely. No. He doesn't have on. No, he had finished works, but he just did not want the attention and pressure of being in the spotlight again. And according to his son, okay. Year after year, he'd say, all right, I'm going to publish stuff now. I'm ready. I'm going to do it. And then he just couldn't deal with it. Didn't want to deal with it. He just did not. He wanted to write, but he did not want the pressure of being in the spotlight and that whole craziness. And he just walked away from it. But no, he kept writing. I don't know that he ever worked with an editor. and had somebody.
Wasn't he a professor at a school?
I have no idea. I don't care. But
or he lived in like.
I don't think he was a professor, but maybe he was at one point briefly or something. But he basically was at home and he wrote every day.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
If he was a professor teaching creative writing, the line to be in that class would have been extraordinary. We've heard a thousand stories about.
Yeah, you're right.
Yeah, so whatever.
Now, are you into gaming, nope. Michael? Because, yeah, neither am I. But then you may have already heard, if you are into gaming, that Ninja is leaving Twitch and he's leaving it for a service called Mixer. Now, if that confuses you, in English, that means the hugely popular Fortnite gamer Tyler Blevins, a.k.a. Ninja. He is leaving the platform Twitch, where he has 14 million followers, kind of like our listenership, to appear exclusively on the Microsoft platform Mixer. Naturally, he and Microsoft expect and hope a lot of those followers will follow Blevins to his new home. That's the reason they're doing this deal. This is major news and follows on the Fortnite World Cup tournament that took place at the same stadium where the U.S. Open tennis tournament is held. By the way, the Arthur Ashe Stadium seats 23,000 people and was sold out all weekend during that tournament. At that event, a 16-year-old kid won $3 million, giving kids everywhere a cutting remark to throw back at their parents whenever one of them complains they are wasting their time by playing those stupid video games. And the kids are going to like turn back and say, no, mom, I'm helping with the mortgage. Is all this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big deal. It's a big switch for Ninja or Tyler Blevins. And how early did he have to get onto the Twitch platform in order to secure the name Ninja? He's not even like Ninja 72. He's just Ninja. It's not like that's an obscure name. But anyway, esports viewers hit $1 billion people worldwide go online and watch esports last year. So there's a survey indicating who has watched an esports tournament in the last 6 months. That's where that info comes from. China, 40% of their internet users have watched an esports event online. Asia is far, far ahead, of course. Western Europe and the US have less than 10% of that market so far, but it's growing. And
I was flipping through the channels the other day, and I came across not Fortnite, but I was on ESPN2, and I thought I was watching a commercial, and it was not a commercial for a video game. It was actually a video game tournament that was being broadcast live. And I thought to myself, I still don't know what's going on here. I have no clue what I'm looking at.
That's what kids are for. You bring them in the room and they will explain everything. And Jeff Boucher has a good article in Deadline. While we were away, he had a good story after the recent shootings where the video game industry fought back to the blame game over gun violence. There's no science evidence really linking video games to an increase in real world violence. And he had a very interesting article on Deadline about that. We've got a link to that in our show notes.
And you know, actually, you can say that video games are played everywhere in the world.
Right, exactly.
China, you just mentioned. Everywhere.
There are mental health issues all over the world, but only the U.S. has massive, extraordinary gun violence. It might have something to do with having so many damn guns around.
Yeah. Okay, so you just took the words literally right out of my mouth. Well, not literally, figuratively. Where can you find the doctor, actually? That's my question. Since you're, you know, stealing all those words from my mouth, you must know where you can get a doctor. Well, in the TARDIS, of course. And if you don't know what a TARDIS is, congratulations, you're a lot like me. And if you want to stream episodes of the iconic BBC series Doctor Who, where the TARDIS plays a most important plot device, well, you're going to have to get HBO Max. Yes, headlines in the trades announced a blockbuster deal between the nascent streaming service and the BBC that included the original sitcom The Office, Luther, and a number of other shows from the BBC. But above all, it announced the beloved family-friendly series about The Good Doctor was exclusive to HBO Max. Well, I don't mean The Good Doctor, by the way. I mean The Good Doctor, as in Doctor Who. Well, you know, not exactly. The TV series Doctor Who has been around since 1963, you might recall. But the deal between HBO Max and the BBC only includes episodes made since its reboot in 2005. That means they got the right to stream the last 11 seasons, but not the 26 seasons that came before that. And it seems like they only got the streaming rights for North America, though actually that's not exactly clear either. And no one has the right to stream the 97 missing episodes from the early days because, you know, those were destroyed by the Daleks. Everybody knows that.
Dalek. Boy, you really don't know Doctor Who. That's the Daleks. Exterminate.
You know why I don't know Doctor Who?
Why? Because you're cool?
Because when I was a kid, I would get Starlog magazine, and they would always have information about Doctor Who.
Of course.
So, of course, I wanted to watch Doctor Who. But it was the 80s, and the only way
PBS.
You could watch... you know what? But it was
every
not
Saturday on PBS. They would show an entire 4 or 5 episode run of a whole adventure of the Good Doctor.
But it wasn't on in New York, at least. It wasn't on the PBS that you could get Channel 13.
It was.
It was on some PBS like Channel 26. And if you only had an antenna, you had to hold the antenna out the window
you
with your
kid.
Leg on the. Yeah, I was a kid. I was like, I'm not holding the antenna out the window. Forget about this. I couldn't, so it always came in. It was very staticky, and sometimes it wouldn't come in at all. And I was like, you know, why do they keep talking about this Doctor Who and Starlog? I can't even watch the darn thing. Mm. But anyways, it's a big deal or a big whoop.
Oh, it's a big deal because of the reporting. Like, I really struggled to find out if they had worldwide exclusive rights, which seemed insane to me that the BBC would give them UK rights to stream Doctor Who exclusively. That didn't seem possible. So I assume that's not true. But I could not find any indication anywhere of whether it was North American rights or worldwide rights. I just couldn't find it out.
Hey, man,
and
it's
I shouldn't
August.
Have to, I, well, yeah, but I shouldn't have to fight. Plus, a lot of them implied that they had the rights to all of the Doctor Who series rather than just the recent incarnation. And that also was kind of sloppy reporting.
Yeah, that's probably because it was being written by somebody who didn't know that the series began in 1963.
That's right. Well, it's time for Inside Baseball. That's where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. We've got a couple little quick hits, and then we'll talk about plagiarism. First of all,
I'm sorry, Michael, but everything you just said has been copyrighted.
By you.
So, yes, so you can't actually say that. You used words like plagiarism. That's trademarked, unfortunately. So we just have to stop talking.
All right. Actually. Well, first, Spotify added 8 million paid subscribers. They are now 108 million subscribers paid worldwide. Now, here's another point that's linked to that. Major music labels saw their worldwide revenue grow, but that growth has slowed. Meanwhile, Spotify has seen their revenue increasing at a faster pace. So Spotify is adding paid subscribers. Major music labels are seeing their revenue growth slow, and they're looking at Spotify over there, and their revenue growth is increasing. Is there a link?
Well, I think the link is that people are going to Spotify, and they are saying, you know what, we don't really have to listen. We can listen to a podcast, or we can listen to some other exclusive content to Spotify. And therefore, Spotify doesn't have to turn around and take that revenue and give it to the labels.
Well, I don't think it's so much that they've grown the other business beyond music. I think it's more that the major labels spend a lot of money to create great content, and this middleman, Spotify, gets to skim off the top. You know, that's
right,
the problem. But who owns Spotify? Who owns the major record labels? There was a very funny story about Tencent, the Chinese company, buying 10% of the Universal Music Group, right? They're looking into doing that.
So Tencent is buying 10%
of the Universal Music Group, and they'll get to buy another 10% in a certain number of years if they choose to use that option. And this article had a breakdown of how everyone seems to own a piece of everyone else. Spotify owns this. Major labels own a piece of Spotify. Record labels own a piece of management companies. They own a piece of ticketing companies. Ticketing companies own a piece of the major. Everybody is so incestuously interconnected, you can't even make sense of it. It's, everybody's got a piece of everyone else. Not a controlling interest. Not necessarily they're going to benefit as much as they should have if they had all the revenue themselves. But boy, it's a very incestuous little world, I think, because everyone thinks like, I don't know where the money is. I want to make sure I'm in play no matter where it's at.
You know where it's at is suing people for, as you called it, plagiarism.
Ooh, well, what's going on there?
Well, I mean, you might recall the Blurred Lines lawsuit. And that was, we have to ask the question, is are musicians really ripping each other off more than ever? Because that's what it sounds like. You might think so, since the courts have been bursting with cases claiming one popular artist ripped off another popular artist. And of course, accusations of plagiarism have been around for a long time, but they really, really, as I mentioned, exploded after the Blurred Lines case.
Yeah, no, really, because when you look at it, before the Blurred Lines case, most legal experts, when they would say, okay, this looks like a case of plagiarism or we can move forward with this, they'd say you need something like very specific lyrics, not including I Love You or Moon, Spoon, and June, but, you know, a very specific lyric that sounds unique and, you know, so just, you know, like if I suddenly recorded a song talking about going down to the Old Town Road, that would raise an eyebrow. or the main melody had to be really, really similar for a long period of time, for a number of bars or an entire verse or the whole chorus, for them to say, okay, this looks like you've got a good case for stealing. Right? That's what it used to be. Now what's the case?
Well, now the case is if you have a kind of like a vibe, you know, like if it kind of feels like the same song, you know, like the courts have decided that beats and even the vague feeling of a song can be copyrightable, and hence Blurred Lines being accused of being too similar to Marvin Gaye's Got to Give It Up. And yes, it kind of did have a similar kind of like, you know, vibe and groove, but, you know, so does every disco song. To they all sound alike. And let me tell you, I just came from Hawaii. You want to talk about songs that sound like one another. Okay. All those songs sound like one. Every single song sounds like, Somewhere Over the Rainbow song by Iz. So, you know, it's what we have now. And the reason this is kind of rearing its ugly head is we have Katy Perry. She lost a case with Dr. Luke, I might add, for a 2013 song. And her people are claiming that how could this possibly be that Dark Horse is a ripoff of Joyful Noise by a Christian rapper, Flame?
Rapper?
Okay. Yeah, okay. It's a Christian rapper, Flame. They said, look, the song uses basic building blocks of music.
No.
You can't.
Yeah, they're saying the songs.
You can't copyright
the
that.
Songs do not share melody, chord progression, a drum groove, or a bass line. They don't.
Well, they're not saying that there is a. Yes, they are kind of.
Yeah, they're saying like this is what they don't share. What they do share is that one musician played on a synth a repeated melodic fragment that helps support the melody, and that's only during the verse, and it's similar to a melodic fragment used in the other song. You know, that's what they share. Not a melody, not a chord progression, not a drum groove, not a bass line, all that. And so they're saying, look, the lawsuit doesn't talk about specific elements stolen from Joyful Noise. But they say there's things like pitch and rhythm and texture and a repetition, a melodic shape. And Katy Perry's people are like saying, that's like copyrighting the tone of a piano. You know,
yes.
It used to be only melodies could be copyrighted. Now it seems like the feeling of a song could be copyrighted. There are no...
And it's really not Katy Perry's people. It's, you know, other musicians saying, what you have just done is you've made it... You're like, we can't even speak. We can't even, like, put our finger down on a piano because you're basically saying, well, that song sounds very like... It sounds like Elton John. It's like, yeah, because he uses a piano too. You know, it's... That repeated melodic fragment is called an ostinato.
Uh-huh.
Okay. And that was what was referred to by Flame's expert witness. Okay. They had an expert witness from the University of, well, it was Washington University in St. Louis, Todd Decker. He's the chairman of the music department there. And he said he had never heard an ostinato, a rhythmic pattern like that, descend in the scale in a similar way. Except for the fact that the ostinato that is being used here is the same exact one that is in a portion of Old Man River, which he himself wrote a book about, and that segment of the song is referenced in that book 9 times.
Well, there are a lot of experts. As with Blurred Lines, after this case was finished, a lot of people, musicians, artists, and musical experts are like, oh my God, this is a nightmare, this road that we're headed down. And there are a number of other cases in the pipeline. Ed Sheeran has a plagiarism lawsuit, but that one is on hold because there's a Led Zeppelin lawsuit that is working its way through the courts, and that one may end up at the Supreme Court. And that would give the 9 justices their first time ever to weigh in on this issue and to weigh in on whether you got to give it up for creativity and inspiration and a recognition that acts draw from one another all the time and that only egregious ripoffs should constitute theft. You know, but that raises the question, why are all these cases happening now? Obviously.
Because frankly, Blurred Lines.
Yeah, that opened the floodgates. But one of the big things changes here is because music's getting older. A few weeks ago, we said, hey, look, some of the biggest acts touring are older. They're really old. Well, that's just because Elton John's older. You know, they can't help it. They're not going anywhere. The Stones are still touring. Bruce is still touring. Elton John is still touring. So they're getting older. So this is like the first era where you could have a senior citizen touring in rock and roll. And it's also the era where artists are dying off, and now their estates are in charge. It's one thing for Marvin Gaye to say, I'm going to sue Alan Thicke, because I think he's ripping me off. Robin Thicke, I should say, because he's ripping me off. That's the thing that a lot of artists won't do for a lot of complicated reasons. But once he's gone and it's his estate, they're like, why not? They don't have some artistic reputation. They don't have to worry about whether they've, you know, been inspired by other artists. They're just like, hey, let's sue. What do we got to lose? Our lawyers will take the case for free. Right.
And well, they don't take the case.
They
for free,
do. They do. But they get a piece of the winnings. A lot of times they'll say, yeah, we'll do that for you. They think you got a good case. They'll take, you don't got to pay them. You only pay them if you win.
Well, in this case,
and they don't have an artistic reputation to worry about.
Yeah. We have links to two videos. By the way, did you know that that Dark Horse video has been viewed over 2.6 billion times on YouTube?
No, I did not.
That's unbelievable. But we have links to two YouTube videos, one by Rick Beato, who you introduced me to, Michael, and the other by Adam Neely. Now, it gets a little wonkish because they are talking about a music theory, and but they're fascinating to watch because they rip apart whether these two songs are alike. And Adam Neely goes into the fact that, frankly, the piece that, you know,
Flame
is actually suing over. Well, yeah, it's been used hundreds of years ago by, you know, Beethoven, Mozart. You know, it's like there's only 12 notes, my friend. You can only put them in so many different combinations. And they just rip. You have to watch them. It's worth
well,
watching.
This is why a lot of these cases are going to juries, because they don't want to be in front of judge and technical experts, because they want juries who don't necessarily understand all these and can be led to think, well, yeah, they do sound the same. That must be plagiarism. Not recognizing that there's 10,000 other songs that use those same building blocks to create a song. So one other reason I think that we're getting a lot of this is software. I think it's a lot easier for your software to track down songs that have some similar patterns, and you can make a graph and a grid and go, oh, look, you can track down songs that are similar and say, hey, mine was first. And you also have the internet where a lot of fans will say, hey, this song sounds like that song. Or this verse sounds like that verse. You know, that's got four words that are the same. So I think there's a lot more ways you can stumble across songs that sound similar to something you've done. So you've got a lot more examples to draw from. You've got estates, you've got lawyers ready to help you sue, and you've got rulings that have opened the floodgates to, you know, making plagiarism be something that's a lot easier to claim and prove.
Yeah, I mean, when you had Sam Smith and
they're just settling, you know, they're like, wait, don't
Tom Petty. Yeah, yeah, well, because, okay, you kind of mentioned two things, lyrics and melody. Okay, two parts of the song that, yeah, okay, they have to be the same. Well, okay, in the case of Sam Smith, what was the name of the song?
I can't remember. Don't worry.
Yeah, but it was Won't Back Down was the Tom Petty song. Well, obviously, the lyrics are different. The melody was exactly the same. The chord progression was exactly the same.
He said, you know what? That is similar. And you know, they came to an understanding, because sometimes you get inspired and you don't even realize it, that you're using some fragment, because so much music builds on music that comes before. So it happens. George Harrison, you know, famously did it with My Sweet Lord and He's So Fine, you know? So it happens sometimes unintentionally. Sometimes it happens intentionally, but normally you can really hear it when it's happening and there shouldn't be much doubt. If you have to puzzle it out, then it's a lot of BS.
Well, you know, Adam Neely said that Todd Decker, I think that's his name. Yeah, Todd Decker, this musicologist, would never make the arguments that he made in court. He would never say that to an academic group, because they would just rip him.
They'd laugh him off the stage.
Right, exactly.
Oh, there you go.
And I would agree with that.
Well, plagiarism isn't going anywhere. That's alive and kicking, that's for sure. But some people have died. A couple people, theater legend Harold Prince, novelist Toni Morrison, and documentary filmmaker legend D.A. Pennebaker. For Hal Prince, I thought all you need to do is just list the shows he produced and directed. But funnily enough, the very first show he saw as a kid was a Mercury Theater production of Julius Caesar, starring Orson Welles, who was 21 at the time. That's pretty awesome. And then as a producer and director, he won 21 Tonys. And thinking of that career, as a producer alone, Hal Prince produced The Pajama Game, Damn Yankees, West Side Story, A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum, Fiorello, and Fiddler on the Roof. I mean, West Side Story and Fiddler on the Roof. That's a huge career right there. Then he decided to start directing musicals. He directed She Loves Me, which is delightful, Cabaret, Candide, On the 20th Century, Evita, ka-ching, Phantom of the Opera, ka-ching, Kiss of the Spider-Woman, and a hugely successful revival of Showboat. Oh, and he also directed a bunch of shows by Stephen Sondheim. Companies, Follies, A Little Night Music, Sweeney Todd, Pacific Overtures, and Merrily We Roll Along. That's an amazing career. He is like mid-20th century popular musical theater. That's just now, crazy.
Did he live in Iceland? Because that's where
he died in Reykjavik, away. Iceland. I think he just had a place there. And frankly, when you know he directed Phantom of the Opera and Evita and Cabaret. Frankly, when I heard he was in Reykjavik, I thought, I didn't know he owned Reykjavik because he's got so much damn money. But no, I think he just had a place there.
Oh, well, I don't know if Toni Morrison was wealthy, but she should have been given she's an acclaimed novelist.
Wealthy in talent.
Yes, that's for sure. And actually this year, I'm pretty sure it was this year, there was a documentary about her.
Yes, it's still in theaters.
Oh, okay. It was at Sundance.
Oh, yeah. No, there's a movie in theaters right now about Toni Morrison. That's how important she is. She died at 88. Her masterpiece is probably Beloved. But her third novel, for example, Song of Solomon, that was named a Book of the Month Club pick way back in 1977. And it was the first book by a Black author to get that honor since Richard Wright's Native Son in 1940. It took 37 years for another novel by a Black person to be named the Book of the Month at the Book of the Month Club. She had a lifetime of work, of course, in literature. She did 11 novels, but she also had some short stories, some kids' books, but she was also the first female African-American editor at Random House, and she also had a long career as a teacher and mentor. But I'll tell you one thing. I hate lists. And, you know, there was a list. Toni Morrison had 11 novels, and Rolling Stone had a list of her 9 essential works. Dude.
Well, just add 2 she more, only did, and then you're
exactly,
done.
For the love of God. I mean, she did have some short stories and some essays, but, you know, the novels are what matter, and give me a break. It's just ridiculous.
Well, okay. The next person we're going to talk about is somebody close to my heart. I did my thesis, my college thesis for cinema studies. I was like a triple major, and cinema studies was one of them. I did it on what was referred to as direct cinema, which is another word for cinema verite, which was in the 60s. You could kind of hold a camera in your hand and follow people around because the technology was getting smaller. And so you had things like Don't Look Back, which, by the way, D.A. Pennebaker directed. You had the Woodstock movie, another example of that, Monterey Pop. So you had all these films that you could actually, you know, were kind of fly on the wall films, you know, no cutting.
Well, there was editing.
Yes, correct. But they would try not to edit. Sympathy for the Devil.
I don't try not to edit. I'm sorry. I don't think that's necessarily true. I don't think that's what cinema verite means.
Well, look, direct cinema, cinema. D.A. Pennebaker, uh-huh. And if you watch his films like The War Room, you'll see he does not, he'll leave stuff in that most other filmmakers would edit out because it's like, well, why do we have to follow this person walking down a hallway?
Right.
That's not that interesting. Just go to the room. Yes. But that is what, you know,
that's what you're referring to. Okay.
Yeah. So that said, when my student film, because I was also a film production major.
Before you became the devil and became an agent.
Yes. When it was being screened at Planet Hollywood, I just on a whim, I found D.A. Pennebaker's address and his phone number. I called and invited him to my student film. He was the first person through the door.
Oh, wow. That's awesome.
And I met him years later at Sundance, and he remembered that. He said, yeah, my kids wanted to go to Planet Hollywood, and it was there. And I thought, oh, what the heck? Why not? We'll go. First person through the door, and I'll never forget that.
That's
and
awesome.
I would say watch Don't Look Back. If you ever see like the INXS video with the cue cards of the lyrics falling, that comes from Bob Dylan's Don't Look Back.
Oh, it's been parodied a million times, not just by INXS. But yeah, he did a lot of films, including Stephen Sondheim's Company. It's called, what's it called? It's called like Cast Album Company or something like that. Original Cast Album Company, which documents the 18 and a half hour recording session for the cast album to that musical. So he's got a link to Hal Prince there. And that technology that, you know, helped him make the stuff he did, he helped develop it, the first fully portable 60 millimeter camera and sound system that made the style of filmmaking he wanted to do actually possible. He's survived by his artistic partner and wife, Chris Hegedus. I don't know how to say her name.
Chris Hegedus.
Thank you very much. So a huge, talented filmmaker. So another loss like Hal Prince and Toni Morrison.
Yeah, and Chris Hedges went on to work with several different filmmakers.
Well, she worked with him all his career too. Yeah, she's still active. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, it's great films. Kind of like our show.
Great podcast. But rough beginning. I'd like to do it over, but you don't have time.
Yeah, correct. As a matter of fact, we don't have time because you should be subscribing to our show on iTunes, the Google Play Store, Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, and hopefully Spotify soon. Anywhere they give podcasts away for free, you can usually find our show. And if you can't, please do write to us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Or you can call and leave us a voicemail and let us know what you think of certain stories we've discussed on the show. 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. That information can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find all those ways to contact us. You can follow us on Twitter. @ShowbizSandbox is our handle, or you can like us on Facebook, facebook.com/ShowbizSandbox. That's where you'll find links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They have their own website. It is whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz can be found online, and every week he's got a new and exciting website for us. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it's katyperryisnotathief.com.
Can't believe we're saying that. But
it's true.
That's true, actually, yeah. But that said, if you can't find any of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry there, why not head on over to michaelgiltz.com, where all of his work is aggregated. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.